Well, I should add, this is my 15th year in teaching comparative religion, and every year I both enjoy it more and want to, as I'm taking this occasion, to recommend it to others. First, I think some distinctions might be made on the term comparative religion. I like to distinguish between comparative religious culture, religion, and comparative theology. I won't spend a lot of time on this, but it makes some difference when we get down to the practical questions. In teaching comparative religious culture, the idea is to make a descriptive comparison of various cultures, which have, of course, religion as part of their makeup. The stress here, therefore, is on description, and you make such comparisons between externals of one religious culture and another as strike the person's fancy. I think most books that go by the name of comparative religion are actually books in comparative religious culture. Secondly, comparative religion, properly so called, is a systematic comparative analysis between different religions as religions and not as cultures. Now, the difference is that not all religions, or shall I say, all things that we call religions, technically qualify as such. Thus, for example, it's rather difficult to talk about primitive religion. It's rather primitive religious culture, or even Hinduism is scarcely, the way I teach it, a religion. It is rather a religious culture. A religion somehow has some kind of deposit of faith and can be somehow systematized. The best non-Christian example of a religion that can be systematized and compared with others is Islam, Judaism, of course, and Protestantism. The third is comparative theology. And here, using the principles that we know as Christians and Catholics, we make an interpretative comparison, either between Christianity or Catholicism and some other religious system, or between any two or three or many of them. Now, I think it is, for practical purposes, especially for teachers of religion, it is, I think, mainly on the level of comparative theology, even though the term might not be used, that I think the utility might be most practical. Now, something about content. In other words, in teaching comparative religion, where can you find material in your regular courses? I'm speaking of, say, even college courses, in fact, very much college courses, but all the way down the line through secondary and elementary grades. Well, I have three possibilities that I have either used or that I know are being used. The content with which such comparisons can be made, either between one religion and another, or Catholicism and some other form of Christianity, or Christianity and some other religion, it may be, first of all, as found in other courses, as, for example, world history, or American history, or geography, or culture, world culture, or literature, whether world literature, or American, or English. In other words, there is room, there is content for comparison in such courses as history and so on. Secondly, the content may be found or available, or you can put it in the teaching of formally religion classes. And the area is immense. For some 7 years, most of my courses, I would say all of my courses, in Catholic systematic theology have been taught comparatively. Now that doesn't mean that I just spend all kinds of time in making comparisons constantly, but never a class, and sometimes whole sections of a class, I will use what knowledge I have of other religions and compare what they believe about the same subject, if they have a belief on the subject, with Catholicism. Thus, when I teach Christology, much of my Christology is comparative Christology. Thus, the comparison between, say, Catholicism and Protestantism, between Catholicism, Protestantism, and Orthodoxy, or Catholicism, Protestantism, Orthodoxy, and Islam. There's a lot of Christology in Islam, more, in fact, than in many liberal Protestants. Now, the light that one religion sheds on another, or for example, in teaching grace. Now, it assumes you've got a whole background of knowledge to draw on, but all that knowledge is invaluable in making comparisons, for example, between the Christian sacraments and other rites. I will say a little more about this. I just want to mention that the content may be the Catholic faith, which, depending on how much knowledge you have of other religions, can be taught comparatively. Then thirdly and obviously, comparative religion may be taught as a distinct subject. Now, this is where I've been doing most of my work. All last year, for example, my Jesuit students, I taught only graduate courses in formal comparative religion. For example, a semester on Hinduism, a semester on Islam, so on. Now, there are three ways, at least, that I have handled the field, and in general, I think they can be handled, where comparative religion is treated as a distinct subject, where you take just one religion, say Protestantism, or Judaism, or Hinduism. Or, secondly, it may be a cluster of religions. And this is the most popular way in teaching at a state university. This last semester, for example, I taught at Northern Illinois a course in comparative American religion. And I have some syllabi that I can leave with you. We'll show you how I structure the course. It's about an 8 or 10 page syllabus, and how I teach with comparative American. I will take, of course, Catholicism, Protestantism, and Judaism. And as I go along, I will keep comparing one religion with another. And it's great. So clusters of religions, which may be within a given territory, or within a given area, or on a given subject, the concept of God in Oriental thought. Coming out with a book sometime late this fall, I think, in comparing four Oriental religions, Confucianism, Hinduism, Islam, and Buddhism, from a Christian perspective. So there are two levels of comparison, and the main principle of comparison is the concept of the deity in these four religions. So the various principles you see of unity. And thirdly, where you make a survey of world religion. Now, I have taught all three forms. I think I have mainly taught the second. For example, a cluster of religions, a course in ancient comparative religions, the archaic religions, the Egyptian, Sumerian, Babylonian, Greek, Roman, and Hebrew. Most interesting, what you have, and the light it sheds, for example, on the origins of Christianity. Tremendous insights. At any rate, the courses that I've taught most frequently would be clusters of religions. And one reason is a practical one. Even a year is too short. A semester is still shorter to teach anything like a good course in world religions. There's just too much there. And then depending on what kind of student you're dealing with, it's a little risky to teach just one strange religion, strange to them, like Hinduism, for a full semester. They've got nothing to hang on to. And unless they were facing my first class in Hinduism and Buddhism at Western Michigan, I was warned by the dean not to get scared when I met my students for the first time. It's just as well he told me. I don't think anybody had any shoes on, had long, unkempt hair, and all the accoutrements that go with that type of mind. Well, they were not bored. They could have taken Hinduism 24 hours a day. Well, they were, you might say, acculturated to that kind of thinking. But most students are not that type. Now the approach. First, as a general principle, the approach will obviously differ as to depth and detail, depending on which of the first three categories or ways in which you handle this in terms of content. However, the approach is not basically different as to method. Now, this is because anybody can make a difference. I don't make a difference, I'm just quoting myself. Not basically different as to method, no matter what the content may be. There are certain norms, or you might say attitudes, that a person adopts. Now, I've got some possibilities, and I'm trying to get practical. I'm talking about these possibilities separate from, or distinct from, complete courses in comparative religion, which have their own methodology. First, in the teaching of history, and I should add by way of a footnote that I just signed my contract for the fourth year with Afield Enterprises as a religion consultant for the World Book Encyclopedia. I work on a contract, and it's delightful because they take your advice. What I did when I first began working for them, you're familiar with the World Book Encyclopedia. My first job was to read through the encyclopedia completely, all the sets, and analyze their religion contents. And since they paid me for it, my criticism was devastating. I discovered, to their horror, that only 2% of the content was religious. 98% was secular. And they're doing a lot of good things to improve it. So what I want to share with you here is some of the ways that, in talking to these people, in the handling of history, how religion, in this case comparative religion, can be brought out. I would recommend spending as much time as feasible, given the subject you're handling, in explaining about the religion of the people that you are, whose history you are teaching or studying. Now, it's a simple fact that most religion textbooks in the United States, and this is from specialists in this field, are notoriously neutral as to religious content in the handling of history. They tend to be mainly political, military, or dealing with such areas of culture as avoid, sedulously avoid, the religious dimension of whether it's world or European or American history. So, now it may well be, and almost certainly will be, that you won't find too much of this in your textbook. Well, that's precisely the difference that ought to obtain between a Catholic school and every other. Telling about the religious motives behind historical events. History, in my definition, is not a chronicle of events. It is the description and interpretation of human events. And without interpretation, you don't have history. Now, the most important events in history have had strong religious motivation. In other words, you're getting behind the bare facts, and you're really teaching history and not merely getting a chronicle. Again, in explaining and coming to know the religious ideas or ideology of historical characters. In other words, the moment you light upon a person who has a religious background to them or motivation or whatever it is in history, you are teaching history. And yet, by the very fact that you're dealing with a variety of characters, you are consequently and constantly able to make comparisons, analyses, and so on, of this person's religion, his attitudes, what he did, in virtue of his religion. Again, in teaching history, to explain the religious conflicts which provoke social and even military revolutions. And all the while, notice when you're teaching history and the nature of things, you are teaching a variety of people who differ among themselves. And their differences, apart from other factors, are mainly their ideologies. If you handle the religious implications that I've just described, you've got all kinds of rooms for bringing out the comparison between various religious positions in terms of the persons, the events, and so on that you were describing. In the teaching, say, secondly, of world culture, again, world culture by definition means you've got a variety of cultures. Giving time to a description and analysis of the religious beliefs of one people or one nation as compared with the religious beliefs of another nation. Now, somewhere, I think, in one of our conferences, I pointed out how indispensable it is for the knowledge of anything to make comparisons. We know nothing, zero, unless we make comparisons. We don't even know God. We've got to at least compare Him with ourselves. And when we can't see anymore, we put a negative in front of a quality that we've got. We are finite. He's infinite. Again, in teaching world culture, to bring out religion as the most important element in the culture of a people. Now, the comparison may be between one people and another, or the same people at one time and another time, or the same people within a given culture, and the changes that took place because of the contrast between their ideology and that of the circumambient culture in which they live, which is what's happening to the Catholics in the United States. We don't know what's happening. Well, we're just either cooling off or warming up, depending on which figure of speech you have, for the people around us. Then, a huge area of comparison. We're still on world culture. In their religious art, architecture, their temples, their customs, their laws, their traditions, their beliefs, their rites. Interesting studies have been made in bringing out the development and therefore the contrast and comparison of a people in one age to the same people in another age through their vocabulary. The same word 100 years ago meant something quite different than it means now. So you can jump all over the lot, provided you have your focus on the fact that you're dealing with religion and you want to compare. And the basis of comparison can be almost infinite. In the teaching, number three, in the teaching of world literature, now this is rich. And what I see, as I constantly see, for example, Barnes & Noble's college series or all kinds of other things they put out, the preoccupation with American and English literature, you'd think there was nobody else in the world. Well, there is. And consequently, there are writings which, now if you know the religion of the people, you can take even a piece of literature, which is not notoriously religious, a piece of Japanese writing. And if you know anything about the Japanese religion as part of world literature, you can bring out elements which give you a basis of comparison between the Japanese religion and, say, Christianity. You don't have to always be waving a sign what you're doing. That's part of the cunning of teaching. Then, part of world literature, now this may have to be on a college level, but I don't think so. There are sacred writings of the various peoples that can be made and are, frankly, part of world literature. For example, among the Hindus, the Bhagavad Gita, B-H-A-G-A-V-A-D, Gita, G-I-T-A. Or the famous Ramayana. Which is a beautiful epic of the Hindus and compares favorably with anything else we can find in Greek, Roman, or even English outside of the strictly Christian literary classics. And by the way, beautifully brings out the dignity and the respect for women in a way that would put a lot of Westerners to shame. The story of this woman who was faithful to her husband through thick and thin, through peace and war, through all kinds of vicissitudes. And more than once in exasperation, he just couldn't understand. And she kept telling him that a woman's place is next to her husband in life and in death. And in the epic, she had 100 reasons for abandoning him. She never did. At any rate, there are all kinds of things that can be brought out, and a great deal of this is being written in good English paperback form. My bibliography in Oriental Religions is around 400 volumes, all of it in English, that is the regular bibliography that I use, and a great deal of it having some of these literary classics. I'm speaking now of world literature. Then in the social sciences, and this is particularly useful. Now I must say, I'm not sure just how you handle it or what courses you teach in the social sciences, but there is immense room when teaching the social sciences for distinguishing in America, since you're teaching Americans, unless you're overseas, the difference in social attitudes which are fundamentally religious in their ground, as between Catholics and Protestants, Jews, secular humanists, then among so-called Protestants, people like the Mormons, the Christian Scientists. It makes the social science more interesting. It also makes it more real. My first introduction, by the way, to comparative religion on a practical level was working for 18 months with the Indianapolis Chancery in planning a program for the social science teaching in the Indianapolis public schools. I happen to be the Catholic representative, And the idea was to develop a syllabus for the teaching of social sciences in the public schools, mind you, from a religious viewpoint. How's that? It's called the Indianapolis Plan and is still in operation. At any rate, in other words, many of the things that take, for example, marriage, instead of just teaching it, I don't know, thank you, how you, do you have handled marriage in the social sciences?
Sociology.
Please?
Sociology.
Sociology. Well, in other words, the difference in the attitude towards marriage and what a difference this can make. The girl, for example, might have three thoughts before she marries a Mormon. She better, because he believes in polygamy. And she ought to know it. No, there's just so much room. In fact, frankly, I marvel myself that much more of this is not being done. And I suppose one reason is it does take work. Well, you've got to study and deepen your knowledge, but it's pure gold in terms of profit. You can do all kinds of things with it, no matter what subject. You just let loose with your imagination, you can do all kinds of things, but you must have some groundwork. Now, in teaching separate courses, I'd like to say something about that. First, in handling, let me take them in sequence the way I mentioned before. In taking a single religion, as for example Hinduism or Protestantism, I would say that the most practical course I believe that could be taught as a separate religion, maybe even in the, well, I would say in the upper grades of high school, maybe before that, would be Protestantism. I do think at least maybe a quarter, could be a month, whatever it is, would be useful to teach a course in American Protestantism. And by the way, a lot of wonderful things happen later on when the parents learn about this, because there's just too much Protestantism, let's face it, in relationship with, to and even integrated with Catholicism in America. I think I gave the figure in one to one group, 40% of Catholic marriages are mixed in the United States. 40%. Which means that there are many Protestant fathers, mothers, relatives, and of course, all their friends and so on. Many of them may be Protestant. At any rate, they're going to be in that world, so I think one of the most practical courses is in Protestantism. Now, there are different ways of handling it. I have found most useful, because this is the way I have been writing, although I have three books in Protestantism, and I can just tell you the philosophy or the ideology behind each one, and each represents one way of handling Protestantism. The one that has been most popular has sold close to 70,000 copies is the Protestant Churches of America. Now that is a taking of each church separately, and I even do it alphabetically. Adventists, Baptists, Christian Scientists. Then to take each religion and deal with it historically, this is in the United, always America, the history, the doctrine, maybe the doctrine and ritual together, then the moral practices or their customs, and then their organization. Now, any one of the four areas would be useful. For example, a course could be taught in the history of American Protestantism, and I commend the Doubleday paperback for your use. You can just cull the history parts, which, believe me, there's just years of research. Shortly after the Doubleday paperback came out, completely revised edition, by the way, I got a letter from Temple University from a teacher there at the university. He wrote to the editor, which he shouldn't have done, who then wrote to me, complaining about my handling of the history of American Presbyterianism. He had 3 pages of criticism. And the editor said, you better answer this. So I took all over a day to do it. And I discovered that he did not know enough Presbyterian history. So I found the sources for him and enlightened him and told him if he needs any more help. But it has been used in many Protestant schools and so on. I'd say every wrinkle has been ironed out. Sister?
Father, is this History of American Protestantism a separate book?
No. No, the history, this is the Protestant Churches of America, which is about a 500-page paperback. Mm-hmm. But each of the major religions has its history. The total would amount to maybe almost 100 pages, which is a lot of American religious Protestant history, you see. So that's one way of handling it, where you take separate denominations. I might just want to take one. It's up to you. You might want to take separate, again. The other way that I've handled, and this is the book called Christianity in Crisis. There I made a comparison between Protestantism and Catholicism. And sometimes the comparison is very notoriously in favor of Catholicism. Well, that's what the editor asked for, and that's what I gave him. That's one way of doing it. That's called Christianity in Conflict. I have a revised edition of that, which I haven't yet. The manuscript is finished, but there are just so many hours per day. The third book came out this fall, and this is, if I could recommend it, it sells for $9.50. If you need a discount, I can get you 40%. It's called The Spirit and Origins of American Protestantism. It is the most definitive work I have written on Protestantism. The Spirit and Origins of American Protestantism. The first volume of the Protestant Churches of America is published by Doubleday, the second by Newman, and the third one by Flom in Dayton. Now this third one takes the major families of Protestantism. Do you mind if I go into some of this?
No.
It's a temptation. What